Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. This is Keith Pennell, and today I've got a special guest all the way from Havana in Cuba, and he is a chemist. His name is Roberto Cal, and he is at the National University in Havana, I'm sure, and we're going to be talking about all sorts of things. We'll start out by the chemistry of sex. That should keep you listening for 20 minutes more, and we'll also be talking about maybe self-assembled layers, but maybe not.
Maybe not.
Maybe not. Okay. Well, there you are. You've heard it.
It's more boring.
welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you, Keith. Thank you very much.
Before we get into your science and your interest in the chemistry of sex, etc., how did you become what you are today, a professor of chemistry in Cuba? Must be an interesting story there somewhere.
Well, at high school, I was involved in military activity and I lost a lot of classes. So I said to myself, what am I going to do with my life now? And then there was the government was offering different scholarships, and one was for chemists, technicians. And so I got in and then started to study chemistry. At the beginning, it was they offered a general course because there were a lot of people that were not studying at the moment. So they were older, much older than me. There was a 29-year-old guy. We call him Grandpa because he was so old for us.
Those were the days.
So and then after that, I realized I really liked chemistry because I was sent to Moscow with some others to prepare myself as teacher of these technical schools. And then something went wrong. It was not very well organized, so we were wasting our time. We decided to start to study engineering at the Mendeleev Institute in Moscow.
Right. So, and for those scientists out there, you know Mendeleev, but for the rest of you, he is just what we call basically the grandfather of the periodic table.
Yeah, and the new chemistry, they would say.
Yeah, that's right.
And so from then on, I just got engaged with chemistry. I got back to Cuba and decided to start studying chemistry at the university seriously.
So the post, you know, the sending away to Moscow was just for 1 year, one semester, one term?
It was 1 year.
1 year.
1 year.
Right. How did you enjoy that? Was that just a big adventure?
Well, I had studied a little bit of Russian before I left, but only very few elementary words to survive.
Right.
My name is, I want this, I want bread, I want rice, I want meat. And when I got there, well, we ate at this diner, and they had this weird system, self-service diner, but you have to pay for what you wanted before you got into the line.
Yeah.
Yes. So I would look around and ask, how do you call this? I went back and then pay for it. And it was very interesting.
So each dish, they didn't make you pay by, say, the weight of the food
Brazil.
No,
by the dish, by each dish.
Each individual dish.
Yeah. It was very good. Pretty good food.
Good.
At that moment, I considered. And as I was 18, 19, something like that, and I had a good time with Russian girls.
Oh, that's worth knowing.
And the good
thing,
that's
how you got into the chemistry of sex.
They were all called Galia, so I didn't have any confusion with the name. Galia this and Galia that, I just switch faces.
Okay, well then, that's beginning of an interesting story, but we'll skip the end result of that. But I mean, so for you, it was an adventure, and you learned a fair amount about the technology of being in a laboratory.
Yeah.
Then you came back to Cuba, and then what?
I studied chemistry.
Right.
And then in Cuba, we have the system that all the graduates, university graduates, the government has an obligation to offer them a job. And the university asked for what he considers the best students to stay at the university. I was selected to stay at the university, at the faculty of chemistry, and I started working there. And then after a year or so, maybe 2 years, a Russian came to help us in organic chemistry. So He stayed there about a couple of years, and then his boss came. And then he boss was there about one or two weeks, and after that he offered a scholarship for me, because I was the only one that knew Russian.
All right. So thanks to Dalia.
That was a good thing. That was a good thing. I was in Moscow before. So then I went to St. Petersburg. It was Leningrad at that moment.
Right.
And I started to work on research. And I did a lot of work. I worked very intensively. The Russians, this supervisor told all the Russian students that came to study, start their PhD, he asked them, are you willing to erase 3 years of your life working here? I wasn't asked, but anyway, I worked at very hard. I knew this was my chance. I was only for 1 year. At the end of the year, he told me, you know, you've done great advances. If you stay one more year, you're going to finish it. You have enough work for your PhD thesis. You're willing to stay? I said, of course.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So then that was it.
Okay.
That's what is it.
Of the two cities in those days, this is what year are we? Are you talking about the 60s or when?
That was the 70s.
70s, okay.
75 to 77.
Okay. Do you distinguish a difference between the two cities from your brief experiences in Moscow and Leningrad, St. Petersburg?
Well, they're both cold. But the climate in Leningrad, in St. Petersburg, is strong because it's humid. It's very windy. But it's very, very beautiful city.
Yes.
It's no comparison. Moscow has nothing to do with St. Petersburg in that sense. It's a right. Beautiful, beautiful city.
And the nature of the people and the feeling of being there, was it much different or was it just a
No,
like
more
Soviet
or less the same.
Era?
There are two big cities, so it's right. not much of a difference, you know.
But one thinks in one's mind, I've been to Moscow many times, but never to St. Petersburg, that St. Petersburg was much more of an art cultural center, perhaps, than Moscow. Maybe I'm wrong.
It is. Hermitage is gorgeous.
Yeah,
simply gorgeous. It has many, many places to visit. It's very interesting.
It.
Yeah.
Do you go back? Have you been back in your
career? No, I haven't.
Career?
Unfortunately, not because okay. It's a very nice place, and I've been very good Russian friends there.
Yeah, me too. Lots of them, in fact. Well, let's get on. You came back to Cuba. Now you've got this fresh PhD.
Yeah.
You're a bit of a personality because you've survived some winters in the Soviet Union.
And, yeah, that's
and
right.
You've done some good work.
Yeah.
Did you go then straight to be a faculty member or was there some idea of industry?
I was already from the beginning.
Oh, I see. So you were hired as a master's.
Now they started with this.
Got you.
How do you call it? Academic categories, you know, yeah. Assistant professor, associate professor,
right,
and so
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
So then at that moment, I became an associate professor.
Okay.
I think that's equivalence. And I started to organize my research, start my research work. And I started when I knew these guys that work at the Oncological Institute of Cuba, of Havana. So I proposed them to work on searching for new drugs, anti-cancer drugs, and I worked in that direction. Coordination compounds was
all right.
my
all
idea.
Right. Copper and zinc and things
like this. More or less, but nothing really good.
Okay.
So that's how I started.
All right, lovely.
And then there was this professor from Moscow, from the State University of Moscow, to visit us. He was working at that time on supramolecular chemistry. His name is Yasimirsky. His father was a great, great chemist. The Yasimirsky equation for the reticular energy and things like that. Well, whatever. And so I started to move in that direction, and then doing supramolecular chemistry, it kind of gets you involved with nanochemistry, and then I moved into the nano area.
Right.
And it was fancy at that time, you know, very fancy.
Well, it still is. I mean, there are an awful lot of people.
Yeah, well, at that time, nobody understood what we were doing.
Well, which is where you can often make, I mean, this is an interesting point for the listener. If you're not totally clear what you're doing, you can make a lot of interesting advances because you don't have any preset sort of phobias. You go into dusty corners of the area and you come up with some interesting result. You may not understand it, but then that leads to understanding eventually.
When people ask me, are you an inorganic chemist? I say, no, I'm a chemist.
Yeah, me too. Right. I teach inorganic chemistry, right?
That's right. That's right. That's the point. Right. But it's you can't make borders. You can't make divisions in science. It's better to say I'm a scientist because it's even
right.
better. We have done a lot of work on mimicking enzymes, and then working with enzymes, immobilizing enzymes to build biosensors and things like that. So we moved into biology a bit and moved back and things like that.
And you have to have a sort of a team also.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't suddenly be a savant, you know, knowing everything about biology
and
enzymes.
Of course.
The team. But let me go back to your point that you're developing or you have developed some sensors.
Yeah.
A lot of people do this. Do you do it in any sense with a commercial concept at the end?
People are dying to get
patents.
Pure science, you know, things.
Well, that's right. But I mean, is there a patent system that's operating in Cuba? I mean, I'm ignorant on this.
There is, but it's very complicated because you have to pay for a patent.
Yes.
And it's very complicated. Yeah. And then you have to be engaged with these big institutions in Cuba. In Havana, there's several institutes, scientific research institute in biotechnology. If you get engaged with them, a good collaboration, then maybe you can get something out. But by yourself, it's very difficult. It's useless at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, outside of Cuba, like North America, Western Europe and things, we don't know. I do not know a lot. I mean, I've met several people from Cuba, but I can't say that I understand the system very well at all. But what I do know is by reputation anyway, that the health system and therefore I presume basic research into biomedicine or epidemiology, that's a focus of science in Cuba. Is that fair to say or no?
It's not only the health system. It's science also.
All right.
We, according to certain standards, international standards, our students are among the best in Latin America. And I've met some of my former students in Europe, and all their supervisors speak very well of them. So
right.
That means they're very good prepared, or at least they were. At that time.
I mean, that's interesting. Because it's an issue. I work a lot in Mexico. Got a lot of colleagues down there now that have got their own careers that studied up here with me. And it's one of these delicate features that you take really good students from, say, Mexico or from Cuba, and you bring them to a big research institute, whether it's Leningrad, Yale, you name it. And that tendency of a lot of these students is, boy, this is really nice. I'm getting much more in the way of facilities, lifestyle. I don't know that I'm going to go back in a hurry, which often means they don't go back. And that is an issue that I'm strongly worried
about. That's a great problem
about.
We have at this moment in Cuba.
Yes.
All the young, good young people are running away.
Right.
And that, the way you say it.
Yeah. So, I mean, how do you stop that?
There's no way. Yeah, by force is the only way, and that's a worse solution. So it's a good thing the government hasn't thought about that because that would be awful.
But, I mean, one way is to sort of get intergovernmental agreements that when somebody comes from a certain country that you've got to go back. I mean, I came here and did a postdoc in the USA.
Uh-huh.
I had to go back to England. I mean, I wanted to, too.
Yeah.
And I had to be there for 2 or 3 years, I forget, before I was even considered to come back.
Yeah.
That doesn't apply these days?
When the Cuban students apply for
that's a problem
with
America.
For a scholarship abroad,
yeah.
They have this condition, but yeah. they manage to overcome
it. So right. And once you put your foot on the soil in North America.
Yeah.
We've got to take a break. My name is Keith Pannell. Our guest today in Science Studio is Roberto Cal from the University in Havana, Cuba, and we'll be back shortly.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. When we were teenagers, my cousin used to scream, "David, you're a Neanderthal." And back then, she was at least partially right. New research suggests that as a person of European descent, I could blame my genes.
There's apparently a significant amount of Neanderthal DNA in our genomes. The first Neanderthal genome sequenced was from bone fragments of three individuals from the Vindija cave in Croatia in 2010.
Two others were obtained from the Altai Mountains in Siberia. The latest came from a bone fragment of a 50,000-year-old Neanderthal, also found in the Vindija cave.
The difference in the sequences between the oldest and the newest individuals is small, suggesting that Neanderthals lived in isolated communities. So where and when did the interbreeding occur?
Previous studies had confirmed that modern-day Africans do not have Neanderthal genes, which suggests the interbreeding with Homo sapiens happened after they left Africa.
Scientists now place the amount of Neanderthal DNA for West Asians and Europeans at about 2-3%, and they've identified 16 gene variants in our genomes that clearly have Neanderthal origins.
These gene variants affect a range of functions in us, such as allergies, depression, blood clots, immunological disorders, cholesterol levels, and belly fat.
Another study found that the Neanderthal gene sequences present in Europeans could influence vitamin D levels and subsequently how we react to sunlight exposure, our hair color, and sleep patterns. Ugh. Sleep and weight, two challenges most of us struggle with. Good thing being Neanderthal makes me better looking.
Oh, the lies we tell ourselves. We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Roberto Cal from the University of Havana in Havana, Cuba. And we've been talking a little bit about Roberto's sort of entry into a career and some philosophical ideas about how one goes about doing science, why it's interesting. Now we're going to talk a little bit about what you do, actually. You're going to be giving a talk here, which is entitled, very provocatively, The Chemistry of Sex, or something like that.
Yeah, of love and sex.
That means pheromones, I presume. So
no, not only.
Okay, well then tell the audience, what's the chemistry of sex?
Well,
and why is it important?
There was a time we were working, we were mimicking superoxide dismutase. It's a very almost perfect enzyme we have inside our body that eliminates superoxide anion. It's very dangerous.
A superoxide is two O's bonded together, a negative charge.
It's considered a reactive oxygen species.
Right.
So there was this professor from Arkansas, Robert Sorensen. He went to Cuba and he told me, "Hey, I'm doing something with nitric oxide. And you're working on superoxide. They're very similar. They're radicals. They're both radicals.
Right.
So why don't you try to do something with nitric oxide?" So we started out. And we were working on sensors for nitric oxide.
And nitric oxide, again, for the list, is NO.
NO, yeah.
But it is, as Roberto points out, it's a radical species.
Yeah. And then I started reading about that. And it happens that it's a very important neurotransmitter in our body. It controls vasodilation. But the vasodilation, it also has to do with the erection of the man, the penis erection. So I started to read things about that. And I decided to give a talk at our faculty about the chemistry of sex, because that's the students are interested in this type of subject, and you can transmit scientific information in a, you know, cool way.
Demystifies sex to a certain extent.
So I was spending a sabbatical at UNAM in Mexico City, and I met this guy from this editorial, and I told them about my notes on chemistry and sex, and said, "Oh, we're interested in publishing your book," and they published it 8 years ago, and that's how the whole thing started out.
So it started out with not with a particular goal in mind, just the knowledge that you were obtaining.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
In fact, probably it was about, maybe it's longer, 10, 12 years ago, nitric oxide was declared by the American Chemical Society as the molecule of the year.
It was Science. Oh, Science Journal.
Science,
1993.
Okay.
Yeah.
1993, a long time ago. But
and,
I remember it well.
In 1998, 96, the Nobel Prize in Medicine was given for this, the study of this molecule as vasodilator.
Dilator. So now you've gone beyond writing books, which is sort of showing you the basis. You're doing your own research target in this area?
Not anymore.
No, not anymore. Okay.
No, not anymore. Then we continue mostly on biosensors, that is mobilizing the enzymes on electrodes.
Ah, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what do you target? Do you target particular disease markers, for example, or what?
Keith, I'm a Cuban.
Cuba with a very good American accent, I got to tell you.
Cuba is a poor country.
Okay.
We hardly have any resources, any facilities. Let me tell you one thing that might illustrate. In Havana, there's only one NMR, a 250. It was at next door to us, but now it's a bit further away.
Did you move or did the machine move?
No, the machine moved because the guys that had the machine in their lab, they moved to this new institute they organized.
That's an issue there which the listener wouldn't actually appreciate. Just moving instrumentation, sometimes it doesn't work where it's been moved to.
No,
I've got a
work.
Machine. I got a 300 megahertz downstairs.
It worked.
And it works, but so they won't move it.
That's just to give you an idea how bad we are in the material sense. So doing science is trying to do the best, but what we have in hand, or what we can have at a certain moment. So sometimes we have good ideas and think, is this possible to carry out? Well, we can avoid this, we can jump this other, we can get this. Okay, we can do it. Or no, it's not possible because there is a step here we can't do in Cuba. Let's keep it away. Keep it in mind for a better moment. And that's how it works. So we could only build biosensors to which we have access. What enzymes could we get? And that's the one we used.
Okay. See? I mean, is it difficult to collaborate with external? I mean, you're here for a month or so in the USA.
On the contrary. It's thanks to our international collaboration, we have been able to continue working.
Okay.
But enzymes, you know, are very delicate. So to send them, then you lose half. They'll lose half of the activity and then you have to work very fast, and that's a great problem.
Well, I mean, I understand exactly what you're saying. And I mean, to a certain extent, it used to be also true in certain universities in Mexico, right? I mean, they just didn't have the instrumentation, but they are getting much better, and they've got more resources, I think.
But one thing in my group, in other groups in our faculty, we decided that we can't justify our material situation and just sit down and wait for something to come.
Okay.
We have to do it. We have to do it whatever it takes, you know.
Right.
And I always tell my students, our brains are not worse than those that live up north. Not only here, but in Europe or whatever. Because that might seem very simple or without any sense, but underdevelopment is not only an economical situation, it's a mental situation. When you live down south, you don't have the possibility to do things better or live better, but you come to the conclusion, arrive to the conclusion that you're not capable of doing better. And that's the worst part of the story, you know.
So that's a big frustration, effectively.
Yes, and then it makes it so hard for us to work on this stuff and publish in more or less acceptable journals.
The other side of that coin, perhaps, is that then you develop better skills in what we might call the theoretical aspects of science, you know, mathematical, physical chemistry, modeling.
And practical.
Oh, and actually in the laboratory.
If we need a bench, we'll build the bench.
Yes.
If we need a whatever,
so
we make it ourselves.
You would recycle solvents, for example.
Of course.
Yeah,
of course.
So here,
that's an obligation.
Yeah, no, I mean,
so there's a lot of things. And you know how to use everything at the maximal capacity, you know. And
it's no disposable society at all.
I was in Spain. I had a good collaboration with this University of Castilla-La Mancha from Don Quixote.
Yes.
And then I had to do something, a glassware thing. And I asked, do you have a glassware workshop or something like that? He said, no, we don't have anything, but we have these, burners, you know.
Yeah.
I was doing it myself.
Yeah.
And then the dean came up and said, oh, what are you doing? Well, I need this, and I'm doing it myself. He said, oh, you Cubans don't stop. No, of course not.
I did a master's degree in England. It was in nuclear chemistry, but I had to blow my own vacuum line.
Uh-huh.
And it was a great satisfaction from glass blowing.
Yes.
Nowadays, we don't have any facility here, and most places don't. You just buy what you need, or you order it.
Yeah,
sort of, you say, this is the design, go for it.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Well, so you've learned a lot about the chemistry of sex, right? So I'll say that probably you know more than most.
No. That's too much to say.
So what's your current absolute favorite thing to be doing right now? You've just got a couple of minutes at the end of this program.
Nanoscience.
It's nanoscience. With a name for what?
Nanoparticles with biomedical application. That's my dream. My son is doing much better than me.
He's also a scientist.
Yeah, he's a chemist. He's a postdoc at the University of Massachusetts.
In Amherst. All right.
Amherst, yeah.
Okay,
Amherst,
lovely. Yeah. But I've got to say, we're run out of time, actually, Roberto. And we didn't really talk an awful lot of precise science, but we had a very, very good conversation.
Okay, thank you.
And that is illustrative, I hope, to the audience that, you know, no matter where we come from, what our backgrounds are, you know, we've got so much in common, all right? And science is just one of those things.
Yeah,
thank you so much for being here on Science Studio.
Thank you.
And Lauren Terrasas, I'd like to thank you for putting the program together. And, of course, always thank the audience for listening. Without the audience, there's always going to be a program, you know, when the tree falls in the forest and no one there, it'd make a noise, you know. But there's a program. We're glad you listened, and we'll be back next week. Okay. Bye-bye.